The Italian entanglements brought some financial resources. They could tax the North Italian cities. It brought considerable prestige, but also these Italian entanglements were costly. The Germans were constantly being bogged down by their Italian concerns, and perhaps then diverted from paying attention to Germany itself. The gravest problem, though, perhaps, was the struggle with the popes, which is generally referred to as the investiture controversy, the controversy over lay investiture. That means the investing of ecclesiastical offices by laymen. Spoken differently, it means a king, a duke, a count, whomever you please, names abbots, names bishops, invests religious officials with their office. In the middle of the 11th century, the German kings or emperors ran into a reformed papacy that had come to believe, perhaps on the basis of all of that monastic reform that we talked about in an earlier lecture, those who pray, ran into a reformed papacy which had really taken on board the idea that lay control of, lay involvement in church affairs was the chief impediment to moral reform in Europe. They wanted an end to German imperial interference in the church. Now, German rulers, of course, from their point of view, in the Carolingian tradition, believed that they themselves, and not the popes, were the head of the earthly hierarchy, a reflection of the heavenly realm. What's the constitution of heaven? Well, it's a monarchy, of course. If earth is supposed to reflect heaven, earth should be a monarchy too. Who is the monarch? Well, it might be the pope, or it might be the German emperor. The German emperors felt themselves divinely appointed to this task. Suffice it to say that the battle, this investiture controversy, went on over two generations, and finally the ecclesiastical authorities won out. We may very well say that in a society that defined its ends and purposes in essentially religious terms, ecclesiastical authorities were bound to win any great ideological battle over authority. So my point is quite simply that that wonderfully promising Ottonian system put in place in the 10th century saw, over the course of the 11th and the early 12th, each one of its key props kicked out from under it. And as a result, Germany then began to pass into the direction of small, disunited, ineffective, centralized control. Now, we've mentioned the Roman Church. Let's just lay one or two words on that particular subject as well. The Roman Church developed in the High Middle Ages the most sophisticated legal system in all of Europe. We'll return to that in our next lecture. The Curia, the central court of the Church, expanded significantly. The College of Cardinals, for example, emerged as a kind of a senate for the Church as a whole. Lateran councils, the Lateran Basilica, of course, is Rome's cathedral church. Lateran councils became sort of church-wide, but increasingly almost Europe-wide parliaments. The Fourth Lateran Council in 1215, for example, exerted more influence on the lives of ordinary people than any church council since antiquity or than any council to come until Trent in the 16th century. The legal and the financial machinery of the Roman Church was elaborated to collect fees and revenues from all over Europe, to adjudicate controversies that came to the church from all over Europe. The Pope's system of legates, we might say envoys, ambassadors almost, he could send them ad hoc for a particular reason, or he could make them resident in particular areas. The papal system of legates brought more people into regular contact with ecclesiastical government than had ever been the case before. The Roman Church in the High Middle Ages developed highly its disciplinary mechanisms. Excommunication, for example. Now, this had existed since antiquity. The exclusion of an individual from the sacraments of the church, a form of social death. No one could talk to, no one could eat with, no one could have sex with an excommunicated person. This was a very powerful corrective measure. The interdict was a tool that allowed the church to deny sacramental services in a specified region. Now, the point here, of course, was to bend someone to the church's will, to make them behave themselves from the church's point of view. But by suppressing sacramental services, people were left bereft of the ordinary kinds of sacramental services they were accustomed to, and they were to bring pressure to bear on their rulers. Finally, of course, the Inquisition, the famous Inquisition, a formal judicial procedure designed to identify and correct heresy, a set of procedures that operated according to Roman law and that was devastatingly effective in at least some parts of Europe. Scholars speak of a papal monarchy, and certainly the popes were now leading the church more fully and more effectively than ever before. But even so, we know, in retrospect, that the authority of the popes was on the verge of severe political challenges. The great lessons, therefore, it seems to me, of medieval political development in the High Middle Ages is that an astonishing array of entities which drew upon Roman, which drew upon Christian, and which drew upon local ethnic traditions emerged. Rather than looking for a single ordering principle, we ought to stand gape-jawed in respect at the immense creativity of these peoples. Territorial states grew in some places, failed to grow elsewhere. Powerful central governments emerged in some places, failed to emerge elsewhere. But forms of government differed a great deal from one part of Europe to another. In this age of expansion, governmental activity was itself expanding as well, and was no less creative than the cultural expressions of Europe in the High Middle Ages, to which we shall turn in our next two lectures.